Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or a seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Andrew Mohama, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Sonali Khurana. Dr. Khurana is an accomplished academic hospitalist and medical educator currently serving as assistant professor of medicine at Rush University Medical Center. She obtained her medical degree from the University of Illinois College of Medicine and completed her internal medicine residency and chief residency at Case Western University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Khurana brings a depth of experience in internal medicine and onco-hospitalist care, having held prior faculty appointments at Moffitt Cancer Center and Case Western Reserve University. Her academic leadership experiences include serving as core faculty and associate program director for an internal medicine residency program, and also as director of education for a large academic hospitalist group. Beyond her professional roles, Dr. Khurana is also a proud wife to a surgical urologic oncologist and a proud mom of two young daughters. Dr. Khurana, welcome to the Doctor's Playbook.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm thrilled and humbled to be here.
It's fun to have you here because for our guests listening, Dr. Khurana and I worked together during my internal medicine rotation when I was an M3. It was the first time I met Dr. Khurana, and I was struck by how good of a teacher she was and how good of a physician she was. And then I later requested to work with her as a sub-I during my fourth year of medical school and deepened our professional and personal connection. And I'm just really happy to have you here for a full-length interview.
Thanks. Very kind introduction. And similarly, has been really awesome getting to know you over the past couple, months, and excited to see where your journey takes it.
Awesome. So I just wanted to make sure, is there anything important in your journey that we didn't capture in your introduction?
No, I think you did a great job highlighting, all the big points. Like most people in medicine, I think my journey's been exciting. It's been long and, at times more challenging than others. And I don't think that I'm exactly where I had thought I would be maybe 10 years ago, but that's one of the awesome things about medicine and internal medicine specifically, that there's so much flexibility to explore a different area and develop a new niche. And I'm loving where I'm at right now. So yeah, happy to be continuing on this journey.
That's awesome. So for people listening, can you describe what a typical week or maybe a typical month looks like for you these days with your work, and maybe you can blend in your personal life with that
too? Sure. So I'm an academic hospitalist at Rush. I've been here for about a year. I spend a good portion of my time on teaching service with residents, interns, students, sub-I's. And when I'm not on teaching service, I'm usually on the solid tumor oncology service, which mirrors my previous roles as an oncology hospitalist at my prior two institutions. On a typical service week, I'm working 7 to 4, 7 to 7 most days, and full-time mom when I get home. In my non-clinical work weeks, I'm doing a lot with my core faculty role for the residency program. So I do some educational stuff with the residents. I do mentorship with the medical students. I sit on a few different committees. I also am one of the quality safety leads for the resident teaching floors. So I review a lot of safety events and see where that can stem up into quality improvement initiatives and ways to better the system. And then when I'm not working and, I'm doing mom and wife things, spending time with family and friends in the area. We consider ourselves to be foodies, so exploring the restaurant scene in Chicago and just good quality time with family and friends and travel every once in a while.
Thanks for sharing. I'm curious to ask you, when you were younger, much younger, when you were a child, did you have a dream job, and was being a doctor part of the equation in that dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been intrigued by medicine. I come from a family of a lot of doctors. But from a young age, I actually wanted to be a teacher. And anyone in my family will tell you that I used to ask for like whiteboards and markers and stationery as presents when I was a kid. And I have three siblings. I would, develop teaching activities for them and teach them on the whiteboard and try to teach them letters and numbers and math. And so I felt like I was really excited about teaching more than I was interested in medicine from a young age. I probably started getting interested in medicine mostly from my dad. Both my parents are physicians, and my mom decided to stay home to be with the kids and raise a family. My dad was a very busy practicing private practice gastroenterologist. He grew his practice from scratch and was working long hours at 6-7 different hospitals. Different kind of medicine, I think, than I practice now, but I think it showed me what it was like for him to have that human connection. I would go to work with him sometimes for Take Your Daughter to Work Day, and that excited me about getting to know patients and getting to support patients, I think. And I saw elements of teaching and counseling in what he was doing. And then more direct clinical exposure as I got older, I think, is how I really narrowed it down that medicine was the right choice for me and that this was the journey I was going to embark on.
That's incredible. Yeah, it seems like you found this way to incorporate being a teacher as an identity into your work as a physician. And to folks listening, Dr. Corona still loves whiteboards. During my sublash, she made a point to pull out her whiteboard to teach me about decompensated cirrhosis. It was a great lesson. And I'm pretty sure you did the same about insulin titration as an M3 for me. So the whiteboard stays part of her interests as a teacher. Well, it's wonderful to hear you were inspired by your father and your mother as well. I'm curious because, you know, I also come from a family of many physicians. Was there a point that you felt certain that you were making the decision for medicine because you truly wanted it for yourself? Or had you always been, I guess, more or less pushed by the familial pressure of being in medicine and what that provides?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get asked that a lot. I think I don't ever feel like I was pushed by my parents, interestingly. I feel like culturally that tends to be the case for a lot of people. But my parents took different paths. You know, my mom deciding to stay home, and that was what was important for them and their family at the time. And my dad working a very busy practice, and he knew that that sometimes kept him away from family. So I know that he knows for me, family's important. I didn't know if he thought that would be the best fit for me too. So they never really pushed me in that direction. To think if there was an exact turning point, I think once I decided medicine was for me, it was always for me. I did an internship in high school at the hospital where I was born, Good Shepherd Hospital in Barrington, and I got to do a lot of direct patient care shadowing, but also direct patient care, scrubbing in on surgeries, and I was really in the deeps of it, almost like an intern without any medical training. And that showed me more realistically what medicine looked like. That was what got me really excited, like I could do this every day.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, I think there's a lot of people who feel pressured, whether by family or friends or just the image of what it means to be a physician. And oftentimes in speaking with people, their why becomes, it evolves even after beginning on that journey or, you know, much further into their career. So for you, Dr. Corona, I'm curious, has your why, you know, while you're doing all of this and putting a lot of effort to being a physician and a mother, has that changed in recent times as you've been, you know, through your residency training and you know, well into your work as a hospitalist?
Yeah, I definitely think it has. I think if anything, I've been more and more convinced in the past 4 years that this is the thing I was meant to do. I was an oncology hospitalist for 3 years before coming to Rush. And at Rush, I also spend a lot of my clinical practice taking care of solid tumor oncology patients. And it's extremely challenging, but it's very rewarding. You spent some time with me on those services. I never thought I would see myself in oncology, but it's really confirmed for me that medicine was the right path because I love the human connection and the sense of, you know, opportunity to get to know patients at a deeper level. Sounds very cliche, but to see them as a person and not patient, you know, as a human and not a case to be solved, and to recognize that patients have values and goals and dreams and fears, and to be able to listen and get that out of them, I think it's really what's kept me going. And I find most of that to be the case in oncology patients, you know, when we're treating more than just a clinical syndrome and, you know, dealing with the patient as a whole and trying to look at the whole picture.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm curious if you could dive a little deeper into your work in the oncology settings. I know you spent some time at Moffitt Cancer Center. You just mentioned, you know, your 3 years as an oncology hospitalist and now obviously still taking care of those patients here. How do you feel like that shaped your diagnostic frameworks, the way you reason through clinical cases, both maybe with your oncology patients, but also other patients in general?
Yeah, I think if anything, it's only deepened my understanding and kind of returning to the basics. My framework for clinical reasoning hasn't really changed. You know, if I have a patient who presents with altered mental status, I still go back to my buckets, the missed pneumonic and metabolic, infection, toxins, you know, structural etiologies. But after seeing so much oncology, I've been able to elaborate on my differentials, my approach, and now I add things that I previously was maybe not aware of, you know, like paraneoplastic syndromes that come with solid tumor oncology or chemotherapy toxicities, autoimmune immunotherapy toxicities. So I think I've just expanded on my previous approach to clinical reasoning, but the basics and the frameworks that I used always are still there. I also think that my experience at Moffitt and prior to that at Seidman Cancer Center and now here at Rush has forced me to go beyond just the technical and clinical, you know, problems that we're treating and be able to address, you know, the broader issues that patients are coming in with, you know, what's important to them, what's important to their family, and how they should be navigating this illness when they're not in the hospital, in and out of the hospital.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was able to witness firsthand how you do value the personhood of your patients, and it was remarkable to be a part of and to be inspired by as well. I'm curious, how do you maintain that level of care for that? You know, I think as a student, we oftentimes don't see the behind the scenes of how much attending physicians have on their plate, especially on some of the services where you don't have a whole resident team. You know, there were days during my sub-I where I was just struck by how calm and collected you were, despite having a patient list of like 15 to 20 patients, and you still taking the time to teach me very foundational lessons in internal medicine. So I'm curious, you know, have you always been this way? Someone who's able to think beyond just the logistics of your day and the tasks that you have to cross off? You know, how did you train the skill and how do you keep it at the forefront?
It's not easy, I think. And I definitely have not always been this way. I think anyone who knows me outside of medicine is shocked to hear that I take care of cancer patients because they tend to be kind of frazzled, emotional, the type of doctor who might sit and cry with my patients, that sort of thing. But I think over time, I've learned how to process and balance my time, you know, as an attending, spend more time with patients who need the counseling, who need the goals of care, who need a little extra emotional support. And on those days, maybe dedicate less time to investigating something for another patient. But it definitely has taken years of training and practice to get to where I am. I think a big thing for me that helps me keep myself in check, I'm a big talker. Like I like to debrief and talk about what I'm processing, what I'm going through with patients to make sure I'm doing the right thing. So even beyond just what I'm doing in my clinical workday here, talking to colleagues on my drive home or a family member or my husband to debrief cases and make sure I did the right thing so I come back the next day with fresh ideas and or confirmation that what I did was right. And that is something that I've implemented into my clinical practice more recently that I was really lacking in the beginning. And I feel like that was part of the reason why I wasn't maybe calm and collected in such difficult scenarios as an intern and a resident.
Mm. So just the act of speaking it out loud of what your mental processes were during the day and maybe a less intense setting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think just it helps me to process what happened. I started my intern year with 5 weeks in the MICU. And I had never done ICU. I had never witnessed a patient die, never been involved in a code. And just those first 5 weeks, I just felt like we would be rounding. Somebody would go into cardiac arrest. We would go do the code. Either they would make it, they would pass, and we would move on rounding and just keep going on. And things like that were happening every day. No one was really talking about it. We were just, you know, processing independently. And I just got to the point where I was almost like burnt out. And I'm like, I'm taking this home with me. I'm not able to process why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling to do better with the next patient. And I learned early on in my training that debriefing and talking about what's happening is so important to my personal well-being, to making sure that I'm doing the right thing by my patients, but for their families. And it's really changed the way that I practice.
That's incredible. Have you, and the answer, you know, doesn't have to be yes to this, but have you operationalized that grounding, you know, exercise? Like do you do it, you know, on your commutes home? Do you call someone? Is it only when you have particularly challenging days? I know, you know, lots of physicians and non-physicians have these like rituals they do either before or after work where they can ground themselves to, you know, reset before the next day. Have you operationalized this or is it more just as needed?
Yeah, I think for me, it's more as needed. Some days I might work 12 hours and come home feeling like I have 100% mental power, emotional power to, you know, play with my kids and do bedtime. Some days I may work 8 hours and come home with 5% in the tank and, you know, just emotionally I'm spent and I need to vent or debrief or discuss what's making me feel that way before I can be a good wife and a good mom and make dinner and do laundry and all the things I need to do at home. So for me, it's just on an as-needed basis. Some patients, some days hit harder than others. But I think I've gotten a better sense over the years of what affects me and when I need to talk about things. And for students and trainees who may be learning, listening, I think that that develops over time. You know, you figure out what keeps you grounded, when you need it, when you don't.
Absolutely. And on that note, would you be willing to share a patient encounter from your work, maybe specifically with your onco-hospitalist work, that has changed the way you maybe think about human connection or these tough experiences?
Yeah, I think one patient in particular comes to mind. You know, it's important when we're asked about patients, I feel like the ones we remember are often the ones who are difficult. You know, majority of patients that we take care of are appreciative, have good outcomes. You know, they're thankful for everything that you do. The ones I remember the most are the ones who either was a difficult encounter, maybe things didn't go the way that I wanted. This patient is probably one of the most difficult that I've taken care of. It was during my time at Moffitt. She was a 24-year-old, newly married, young woman, talking about kids, wanting to have kids, start a family. And she came in with rapidly progressing symptoms, leg weakness, urinary retention, back pain. She was found to have a very aggressive paraspinal mass with findings of leptomeningeal disease on her imaging. It's like her life changed overnight, you know? And I remember sitting and talking with her about how chemo may affect her fertility and what that means for the goals and plans she had for the next couple of years. Meanwhile, I'm pregnant with my second child at the time. So just a level of difficulty I never anticipated having to share and talk about with my patients. And I think what was really unique for her is over the next 2 years, I probably took care of her on the inpatient side 3 or 4 times, even though I wasn't her primary doctor. As a hospitalist, we rarely have that continuity with patients, but because she was readmitted so frequently, I got to see her, get to know her, understand where things were at mentally, how she was dealing with this from a family standpoint. And I think focusing on listening and spending extra time with her family to support them through that really reminded me of, I guess, the why, you know, why I do this, that human connection, that listening can go a long way, and that patients need a doctor who is not just there to treat them, but to listen and, you know, give them a sense of trust and someone who's going to sit with them in difficult spaces in their most vulnerable moments. So I think that one really sits with me. She's doing well, surprisingly. I mean, she is no evidence of leptomeningeal disease now, 2 years later, and usually lepto confers a prognosis less than 6 months. So I think, you know, I remember this case not because she had a quote unquote happy ending, mm-hmm. but because it challenged me at like every level. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the cases I feel as a hospitalist I've really actually been able to make an impact.
Oh, that's incredible. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, it's interesting when we like see ourselves in patients sometimes, you know, close in age or in life circumstance, and, you know, they're in the hospital bed and you know, we're the fortunate ones, you know, take care of them, you know, ideally, hopefully in better health. But I feel like that's been a common experience for me when I especially have younger patients I'm part of the team taking care of. You know, as a med student, we are sometimes standing and observing, and it's hard not to sit there and wonder why, you know, the coin got flipped a certain way for some folks and others. But I think it's important to, like you said, share these things out loud and keep those patients in your memory as your why moving forward.
I think it gives you perspective too into your own life, right? You know, we often take things for granted and you never know, you know, what's in store for us or what, you know, what tomorrow might bring. And I feel like taking care of all these young, especially oncology patients, but young patients in general, who I see a lot of myself in, like you said, it gives me perspective on, you know, being thankful for what I have and using my time with good balance and spending time with family and friends and doing all the right things so that I don't have regrets.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting, like you see a lot of suffering in a hospital and it makes you more grateful. And I feel like, you know, my life, it's like I just visited my family back home. My parents still live in South Dakota where I grew up, and I like delayed my flight a couple extra days to stay there longer. Just I feel like as I've grown older, and especially as I've gotten deeper into the medical world, you see the fragility of human life. And that definitely for me has translated to desiring to see my parents more, to call them more, mm-hmm. and to, you know, hopefully leave things said rather than unsaid.
That's really great. Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing some of those, you know, challenging experiences. I think a lot of people listening probably, you know, don't have spaces to share them. So I'm hoping folks feel a little bit inspired to maybe talk with their friends or their partners or mentors about those experiences. It can make a big difference. Shifting back to some more of your interest as a teacher, I noticed that you created what's called the Resident as Teacher curriculum, and you co-directed this capstone course during your time in training and as an attending. So I'm curious if you could speak a little bit about what that curriculum was and also what gaps you saw in training that led you to actually start those initiatives.
Sure. Yeah, I was very fortunate actually to be a part of an extremely robust leadership and medical education pathway in my residency. It's one of the things I sought out when I was applying for IM. I looked for programs that had dedicated med ed tracks, and the program at Case Western felt the most robust, multifaceted. We got to explore, you know, lectures at the business school and do other things. And I felt throughout the course of my 3 years in residency that I had all these awesome experiences to learn how to better educate our learners, how to give better presentations, how to understand emotional intelligence. And that is integral to what we do every day as physicians too. You know, we're constantly teaching each other, our peers, our trainees, our patients, their families. And why is that not a part of every residence curriculum? So during my chief year, me and my co-chiefs, we felt that we should try to give all the residents or the larger residency program an opportunity to grow and develop their teaching skills too. That was sort of what prompted us to build the Residence as Teachers curriculum. One of the main parts of that curriculum was a teaching session that we called High Five, or HY5, High Yield Topics in 5 minutes, which is similar to the whiteboard teaching that you've seen me do when I'm on service. But the concept behind it was that it's a lot easier for residents to prepare a 5-minute teaching session on a very specific topic than to present a case and do teaching points for 45 minutes over a PowerPoint. And similarly, learners tend to learn better in bite-sized increments rather than in big bolus teaching too. So we would have 4 residents selected for each session. They would pick a very niche topic, you know, like anticoagulation for DVTs in cancer patients. And we would take a whiteboard outside when the weather was permitting, and we'd kind of hype people up, and they would come up and present their topic. And, you know, other residents would be sitting on the steps outside the hospital. We'd learn from each other, give them feedback. And it was kind of a growing process over the course of that year. And the following year when I was an attending on faculty at Case. So it was really fun. I just felt like, you know, I did my senior grand rounds on residents as teachers, what some of the barriers we have to teaching when we're on service and, you know, ways we can overcome those barriers. And I just thought to use that opportunity and what I'd learned during my thesis to work on making the program better, teach all the residents some of the skills that I had learned through the residency education track.
Oh, that's really great. It seems like a lot of people in internal medicine, like you, love this idea of teaching, but to actually formalize that curriculum and put it at the forefront sounds like an awesome opportunity. You know, I'm curious, what would you say from your experiences, you know, teaching residents and now, you know, as I'm attending teaching residents and students, what's a common barrier people have to overcome when they are given this task of presenting something? Like when you're on service and you say, come back tomorrow with a couple minutes on this, and what do you notice is like the challenge people face, or what do they struggle with in these presentations, and how would you recommend people moving through that challenge?
I think for most, there are probably 2 things. The first is time, and the second is comfort level with the topic. To the time piece, I just think that smaller bits of teaching is always the right choice. There's no reason why in a busy clinical workday we should be teaching, you know, with a PowerPoint for 20 or 40 minutes, aside from like morning report and reviewing cases. But I mean, with the team, shorter bits of teaching, I feel like, is easy to overcome that. The confidence piece is a little bit more nuanced. And I think a normal part of training and growing in medicine, even still, when students or trainees ask me to teach about a topic that I'm not that comfortable with, I express vulnerability in that. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with saying I don't know, and the way to overcome it is to just sort of create a safe space and create a culture where vulnerability is seen as a strength and not a weakness. And anytime there's a topic or something we can learn from and someone is presenting on it and they haven't done it before, to set that culture gives them space to present it in a nice way, you know, and to feel that they can use this to learn and grow themselves and to teach each other.
That's good advice. Do you feel like that's transition or translated to your experience actually caring for patients? Like this, you know, saying, you know, I'm not too comfortable with this topic or I'm not really sure about this. Have you found that your experience is teaching in an academic setting led you to be maybe a better clinician in terms of be vulnerable with them?
Yeah, 100%. And I don't know if that's the right choice. I think patients want to know that their doctor is confident. Mm-hmm. But in times of uncertainty, I'm definitely one who says, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And I think expressing vulnerability, even with patients, allows them to feel comfortable showing their emotion, what they're feeling. It doesn't tell them that I'm not trying to figure things out. It just tells them that we're calling upon experts, we're doing more tests to get to the bottom of things, and I don't think there's anything wrong in expressing that level of uncertainty. I think it can be really productive to making advances in patient care.
So with that kind of topic of not knowing and ambiguity, how do you help learners, maybe especially early learners, sit with that ambiguity without rushing towards, you know, quote unquote, right answer or the right plan or the right assessment? Do you, you know, what's your strategy for encouraging folks to sit with ambiguity?
I think I'm one as an attending who expresses myself as being vulnerable. And I think that hopefully opens learners up to feel like they can feel comfortable saying, I don't know. I think one of the awesome parts about working in academic medicine is it's meant to be sort of like a team effort. And we learn from each other. We work together to get to the answer for a patient. And I find oftentimes when I'm on teaching service, especially even telling the team, oh, I'm not sure about this. I'll have to look it up and circle back later. I think helps them to feel more comfortable where if I ask them something and they don't know, that they can say the same thing. And it helps to go back to the basics again, make sure that we're not, you know, anchoring on one thing and we're reviewing all the data for a patient and figuring out a clinical problem.
I love that perspective. I think I experienced it working as a student on your team. And I think I've, you know, you notice as a medical student rotating through different physician-led teams, how just the atmosphere and the emotional environment they create can translate to how people feel on a day-to-day basis. You know, have had, you know, more traditional and intense physicians I've worked with, and I've had more laid-back ones and ones who create kind of more of a safer space. And it does truly impact the learning environment. I feel like, you know, there's been a lot of baptized by fire experiences that I feel like what I learned didn't even really stick with me that well, because mm-hmm. what was so overwhelming was the stress response that you have mm-hmm. when you're trying to remember something or teach something or present something, that you're focused less on the content and more on the delivery of something for someone else's, you know, approval. So kudos to you for creating that safe space for students and resident learners.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I love academic medicine, because similarly, I think I take better care of patients when I'm doing it as a team. There are always things that students or residents recognize that I may have missed, or I may have been paying attention to something else. And I'm learning something new about the system, about Epic, about patients, about, you know, clinical problems every day from them, just the same as I hope they're learning something from me. So I'm drawn to academics for that reason, that I feel like there's so much opportunity to learn from everyone who's a part of the team.
That's wonderful. Shifting a little bit more to some of your perspectives from maybe your personal life and how that intertwines with your work as a hospitalist, I'm curious how being married to someone in medicine, you know, your husband's a surgical urologic oncologist, how being in that dual physician household has maybe shaped your perspective on medicine?
I think it gives me an interesting perspective. It's been difficult at times for sure. And I think we recognize that communication is key to making sure that we are 100% committed to work and 100% committed to home. I think it's given me an appreciation for other specialties too. I've recognized difficult things in his job that I may not have appreciated otherwise being an internist. And similarly for him, you know, days that I come home after having difficult conversations with families, he has, you know, been able to support and empathize with what I'm doing based on hearing stories over the years and knowing from his personal experience what he goes through. Mm-hmm. I've heard different perspectives from those who are, you know, have partners who are not in medicine. Kind of refreshing to come home and talk about something that's not work-related, not medical-related. For me personally, I thrive in, you know, being able to talk about my day and being able to debrief what's happened with my day. So oftentimes, my husband and I are driving home at the same time from work, and my commute's about an hour, and I use that time to debrief with him about what happened. I find that to be really helpful, and recharge a little bit on the way home so that when I get home, I have the mental bandwidth to be there and be present. But it is interesting. I saw something on social media today, actually, where a wife was saying, you know, her husband sort of gets whichever parts of her are left over, like work gets all of her drive and her energy, and her kids get the softness and the emotion. Emails get all the focus, and, you know, her husband just sort of gets what's left over. And we've been together 14 years, so we've gone through periods for sure where we've, you know, dealt with training and difficult times and being busy and having conflicting schedules. I think with communication, we've gotten so much better at just being supportive of each other, being able to say, hey, I have 10% to give today and I have 90% to give today, and the other person knowing they need to kind of meet the rest of that to be the best that we can for our kids too when we get home.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I think a lot of medical students and certainly residents as well are, you know, maybe not married yet, don't have kids yet, but think about these things a lot, and I think can catastrophize any number of realities, you know, being with someone in medicine or not in medicine, or having kids or not having kids. So it's refreshing to hear your perspective on the other side of it. And I'm curious, you know, some people have shared that when they become parents, it changes the way they are at work, or the changes specifically in medicine, the way they are as a physician. Do you feel like that's been the same for you since becoming a mom?
I think it's taught me to be more patient, more calm, maybe a better listener. I think being a parent, I've learned that things don't always go the way that I thought, that I can't control everything. And that translates to medicine and patient care. And the way I've kind of overcome that is just by kind of being patient, looking at everything holistically and understanding that other variables come into the mix that I may not be able to control. And I guess parenting has helped me to translate that to medicine too.
That's great. Now, shifting gears a little bit to experiences that maybe one might consider a failure, traditionally speaking. I like to often ask guests, what's a favorite failure you've had? Something that maybe in the moment felt like a setback, but ultimately made you a better clinician or a better person today. This can be at any point in your medical training, some sort of favorite failure you've had.
The one that comes to mind is pretty early in my training, and it kind of draws back to the theme about debriefing and, you know, being prepared. One of my first patients I took care of in the MICU as an intern was a 70-something-year-old female, and she came in, was rushed to the ICU emergently for an expanding thoracic aortic aneurysm that was compressing her trachea. And as she was being wheeled into her room, they were immediately intubating her. We didn't even have time to discuss if that was something that she would have wanted. We sort of assumed that the ICU would have discussed it, and then her family shows up, and over the next couple of days, we determined that she wasn't a surgical candidate and probably there was not much else that we could do. And that compassionate extubation and kind of comfort measures was the only option. We had those discussions with the family. They processed everything. They were prepared and they didn't want to be there when she was extubated. So they went to the family waiting area and we extubated her, and then they came back and I was in the room and she sort of took her last breath and they panicked. And they were asking me, is she dead? And I had never been this close to death. I had no idea how to pronounce a patient. The nurse was asking me to pronounce her, and I couldn't find a senior and attending in that moment. And I panicked, you know, I didn't know what to do. And because I went through that experience, I'm very mindful and intentional with, you know, processing similar situations with my team, preparing people for what might happen, what could happen, both families and trainees, I think, in these situations. Definitely could have handled that situation differently. I think would have wanted or hoped for a little more support leading up to it so that I was prepared for what could have happened, you know, and that I could handhold with the family a little bit better than I did. But it definitely gave me perspective, and it's changed the way that I do goals of care and prepare patients and families for all the possible outcomes. And like I said, similar with with trainees who might be taking care of a patient who we're expecting could have a, you know, a setback or some similar situation.
Yeah, I imagine it must have been quite terrifying.
It was terrifying. I'll never forget it. It's changed the way that I ask code status when someone gets admitted. Wow. It's changed the way that I, you know, deal with a rapid response situation. Mm-hmm. It's changed pretty much everything about how I handle critically ill patients.
Right. What would you, what advice would you give to people, you know, starting intern year in internal medicine? I think about myself, and in less than a year, I'll be an intern in internal medicine, hopefully somewhere. And I'm curious, like say I start on the MICU, what would you tell someone like me you know, the weeks leading up to my first shift as NICU as a fresh resident.
Yeah, I think even before residency, if there's an opportunity for people who are listening, is to try to expose yourself to things in medical school. I think once you become an intern, you're expected to be somewhat prepared for independent practice. You know, a lot of things, you may not have someone directly next to you when it's happening. So if there's an opportunity to do an ICU rotation or step down or somehow expose yourself to patients who are a little more sick in med school, I feel like would be helpful for preparation. That being said, many students do not before they start internal medicine residency. I think the best way to prepare is just to ask questions. You know, set expectations for what you know and don't know when you start so that your seniors, your fellow, your attending can prepare you for the areas that you might feel anxious about, unprepared for. And I think with the right type of supportive culture and team, it shouldn't be a problem. And I had the most amazing, wonderful MICU experience over the course of my training. Our attendings were some of the best you could ever imagine. It just happened to be an instance where nobody was physically there. But in hindsight, had I prepared a little bit more for the inevitable first time I experienced a patient's death, I think I would have felt less, you know, flustered and upset after that situation.
Sure. That's good advice. It's also reaffirming my decision to sign up for a MICU rotation.
I think I told you that. Yeah.
So then thinking, I guess, for people who are graduating residency and starting freshly as an attending, what would you recommend to them before they are kind of the supervising physician? I mean, hospitalists, of course, aren't, you know, the ICU attendings, but there's still very severe circumstances where you have to decide whether to escalate care as a hospitalist. You're still experiencing a lot of death as a hospitalist. Yeah, what would you recommend to fresh attendings?
That's a great question. I actually feel I was the most comfortable with sick patients as a first year attending, because as a resident, we were running all the codes in the hospital, running all the rapids in the hospital. I felt like I could walk into a room and, you know, handle something with relative ease. And the further I got away from residency, maybe the less comfortable I got with that. I guess advice for new rising attendings, if an opportunity arises to be in an academic place, I feel like that has kept me sane and maybe calm and comfortable and confident with my patient care decisions. It's a place where there's a kind of a collaborative learning, interdisciplinary, you know, education and opportunity to work closely with consultants to make sure that you're not the only person making a decision for a patient. I also think that being at your home institution adds another level of comfort. My first year as an attending, I was at the same place where I did my training. So if I had a cardiology question, I knew most of the fellows to just call and ask a question to. I understood the system. I knew how to get around the hospital. So the only real thing that I was doing was practicing being the safety net for the residents and for the patients I was taking care of. So it eliminates some of the other fears of being in a new place in a new institution. But yeah, I think a lot of it is just time and seeing more patients and getting more comfortable with certain things and asking when you don't know, and we all get through it.
Thanks for that advice. On the flip side, do you feel like there's advice that maybe you've been given or that you've heard about throughout your training that you think should actually maybe be ignored or shoved down a little bit?
Let's see. I think more recently, there's been a lot of talk about technology and advice for how we should or shouldn't use technology and AI and other things in our clinical practice. I feel like I challenge that a little bit. I've seen a lot of benefit in, you know, the transition to using more and more technology in our day-to-day, and medicine is advancing so quickly. I feel like we owe it to ourselves to learn how to use the resources that we're going to be given and are being given. So maybe that is something that I would challenge. Even like ChatGPT, I sometimes will feed like an educational teaching session I'm planning to give, and just to kind of refine and reassure myself that the points I'm given are accurate or eloquent in the way I'm presenting them. Similarly, I feel like learning from social media and podcasts and other things is such a cool way that we're being exposed to medicine and how other people think, that we should try to lean into that and not, you know, shy away from that, back to tech, you know, back to like textbooks and evidence and things like that.
Right. So you don't think everyone should walk around with Harrison's book just in their hand?
And, in my entire residency, I carried pocket medicine like in my white coat, which is honestly, in hindsight, it's so interesting, because up to date, I mean, now I'm going to sound very ancient, but Up to date really was just new and becoming part of our daily routine when I was in residency. But I was turning to pocket medicine for a lot of diagnostic uncertainty and clinical reasoning and figuring out what's going on with my patients. And I still have it actually in my drawer in my office, but I can't remember the last time I opened it and looked at it.
It seems like that was really popular, even up until recently. You know, my older brother, he's a cardiology fellow now, but he did his internal medicine training, you know, a couple of years back, and he was using that as well. And he gave me his old copy, and it's like collecting dust at home. I had these like grand ideas of how I would use it in my rotations, but I never did. Do you ever see students or residents pull it out?
No, I haven't. And I'm curious, maybe I'll go back and look and see, but I just feel like things are getting, there are just better and better ways to get answers to what we want to know.
Right.
Like, I feel like what I used to look for in pocket medicine, I then transitioned to looking for in up to date. And then when up to date, still you need to feed through a bunch of filters and click on a bunch of links to find what you're looking for. Open evidence is kind of more streamlined into getting the answers that you want. So I'm curious to see what's next, but I feel that what you find in pocket medicine, you can otherwise get quicker and, you know, more directly from something else.
Right. Yeah, it's really fascinating because I've heard so many mixed opinions being the learner and hearing advice from, I've had people say, go home and get the Harrison's textbook and read the chapter on hyponatremia or read the chapter on, you know, AKIs. And it's, and like in that situation, it's like, that's the advice I'm being given. So I'm like, okay, well, maybe we'll try that out. But I think to your point of challenging the fear around this technology, efficiency in medicine, it seems to be so crucial to giving us more time to be with patients, to teach our learners, to hopefully not have such high of a note burden. You know, there's all these tools now, assisting the notes. And I personally am really excited also about the future of these technologies. You know, there are repercussions, obviously, like environmentally, you know, intellectually, all these things. But I would guess, I mean, I'm young, but I would guess that this same thing when, you know, electronic medical records were introduced, and people were probably wondering about the repercussions of that. Or, you know, you think about like the history of medicine, there used to be like nothing, and they made it work, and then they continue to move forward. And, you know, we have the backbone of these more traditional ways to practice. So if all else fails, we know how to lean on it, but it'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I think everything that's advancing and changing has always been, hopefully, with the intention of giving us better balance. So you're right, as technology advances, maybe it takes away from like the burdensome charting and documentation, and it gives us more time to get back to the roots, which is spending time with patients and taking care of patients. That's the hope, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there's going to be now a couple series of questions that are a little bit more rapid fire. So kind of just like first thing that comes to mind, feel free to extrapolate on them. We'll go for a couple of them. If you could gift one book to every new intern, what would it be? Doesn't have to be medical, it can be anything.
Not directly medical, but one of my favorite books by an author, Atul Gawande, is The Checklist Manifesto. I'm a big checklist person. I'm a person who has to write things down to make it a part of my life and to make sure I accomplish my tasks. I think in medicine, a lot is done based on checklists and algorithms, and he does a good job of articulating that, translating that into clinical medicine and to your daily life too. So I feel like it's a good book in residency when you're trying to figure out how to manage your time, how to accomplish tasks, and it seems relevant to every intern.
You're not the first person actually to say that on this podcast. Daniel Bachter, who is now a chief resident at UCSF, also said Checklist Manifesto.
So I guess people have to read it.
Seems like the book to read. If you had the opportunity to put some phrase or quote on a giant billboard right outside of Rush for everyone to see every day when they show up to work, what would it say?
My answer for Rush versus just a general billboard are different. I think for Rush, from a patient standpoint, what I would want to see from like a healthcare system that I'm trying to get care at would be treat the person, not just the patient. Mm-hmm. Just reminding us that, you know, we're in medicine to be humanistic and to be real with our patients. And I think that's something that would be important for me in a healthcare system that I'm exploring. As a larger sort of motto or something that I live by is try something new, you know, color outside the lines, do something different. I think everything wonderful that has happened in my life has been from challenging myself to do something I didn't expect that I would do. And I'm grateful for the experiences that I've had and the people I've met along the way because of that. So I, you know, especially to people who are applying maybe to residency or medical school, think, to consider something you didn't think that you would consider because you might find a really unique outcome from being in a place that you didn't initially anticipate you could be.
I love that. That's a great answer. Is there a small purchase under $100 that you feel like has had an outsized impact on your daily work or life?
Yeah, 100%. A planner, a daily planner is with me everywhere I go. Very old-fashioned, I guess, in that sense. My favorite is probably something called the Passion Planner. It's under $100, and it does an excellent job of outlining day-to-day meetings, day-to-day tasks, goals for the week, milestones, things that you're proud of. It's excellent for organization and for sort of reflective practice. And I use different colors to keep myself organized. So yeah, I would recommend it to anybody. I should probably transition to using my phone and my phone calendar and things that I can carry with me. But my planner is my roots.
Yeah. I mean, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. Yeah. If it works, it works. What's a question that you wish trainees asked you more often?
I guess I wish trainees asked me what I do to keep myself grounded. We talked about that a little bit earlier, but I think that's something that's important to hear and to learn from an early stage of training, and to get the reassurance that life is not just about your job and medicine and taking care of patients, and being able to have a balance and find things to keep us sane outside of the hospital is so important. So I feel like I wish we talked about that more openly. I wish it was normal to be able to share that and make that a natural part of, you know, what we do as mentors and teachers in the hospital.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I'm reminded of when you first started on service when I was a student, you gave us all a handout and you detailed exactly kind of your thoughts about how you like things to go, how you recommend, you know, an open communication environment, et cetera. Did someone do that before you that you were inspired by to also do that as an attending, or was that your idea?
Yeah, actually, one of my mentors at Case Western, who's one of the original founders of the Clinical Problem Solvers podcast, we overlapped for 2 years at Case. He was the person I turned to when I was becoming an attending for the first time, and I was terrified, like imposter syndrome, and wondering how I was going to be able to do it. And he gave me pointers on what worked well for him when he was starting out. And I think, based on my experience too, I got the sense that that would be helpful. I thrived in learning environments where I was given clear expectations and I understood the way that the day was going to run, the workflow, and I felt like I operated better when I had guidelines. So I similarly do that for my teams too.
Yeah, and being on the receiving end, it is super helpful. I feel like I returned to that a lot in the first few days working with you, and it's made me want to do that when I'm an attending someday.
Awesome. I think
it's a really, really smart idea. And I guess in closing, if there's one lesson that you'd want people listening to this episode to take away from your journey, what would it be?
I'll say just trust the process. You know, I think that medicine is a really long road, and especially for students who are trying to figure out what field they want to choose, where they might want to go, to just trust the way that things happen, to maybe explore something new that they weren't initially considering. I feel like I'm as established and happy with where I'm at in my career because of the place where I trained, the people I trained with, the medical education track that I was a part of. And I never would have fallen into that without my husband matching in Cleveland the year before me. I thought I was going to be a Chicago lifer, you know, Illinois lifer. And I think my career trajectory would have looked very different had I done that. I was given such unique opportunities at Case, working with Keith Armitage, one of the most amazing program directors of all time, and fell into a lot of roles and experiences because of being at that place. So for other people who are considering staying maybe at their home institution for residency or fellowship or as an attending, I encourage you to explore a new place and consider being somewhere new. And you can always come back to where you're from or where family is. But there's so much to learn and so much growth to happen from being at other institutions. And I've bounced around quite a bit to know that I've really benefited from learning at different places. So I really encourage and challenge people to try to do the same.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for joining today for Doctor's Playbook. I feel like I learned a ton, and I'm sure our guests will too. So thanks, Dr. Carana.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.